The philosopher C.E.M. Jode was one of the most colourful academics of the 1940s, often appeared or was heard on the radio. And on one occasion, while he was dining at his Oxford College, he found himself in conversation with a rather pompous lady who clearly wanted to make an impression on those sitting at high table with them. "Professor Jode," she said, in deliberately loud tones, "we would like to know your opinion of God." Joe thought for a second or two, and then with his characteristically dry humour, he replied, "Madam, I should think it a great impertinence were I to express my opinion of God. The unceasing concern of my life is to discover God's opinion of me." It was a shrewd rebuke. And one I think it would have done Job good to hear. You see, Job entertained none of Professor Job's reluctance about expressing his opinions of God. On the contrary, he had voiced some very strong opinions on that score, and as those of you who were here last week remember, they were none too complimentary. Job felt he had a right to complain. All his life he had been a man of impeccable piety and righteousness. Nobody could possibly have taken more pains to avoid the slightest possibility of incurring God's anger than Job had. And yet, in a series of utterly inexplicable disasters, Job's world had suddenly fallen apart. His prosperity had been lost, his family had been killed, his own health had been ruined. And Job, in common with suffering humanity the world over, found himself asking the age-old question, why? Why me, God? See, in Job's society, the general view was that all suffering was a form of divine retribution. His three friends, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, were not slow to interpret his misfortunes in precisely that way, were they? "There must be some secret vice in your life, Job, for which God is punishing you," they said. "That's the only explanation." But Job was adamant such was not the case, and no amount of hectoring by his insensitive friends was going to make him yield on that point. "No," he insisted, "I've done nothing to deserve all this trouble. Your theory of retribution simply doesn't fit the facts. There are thousands of wicked and irreligious people in this world who don't suffer in the least. And yet here I am, an innocent man, utterly devastated by misery. Now, I say God's got some explaining to do," said Job. "You claim he's sovereign. My opinion is he's simply arbitrary. You say he's wise. My view is he's totally irrational. You say he's just. My experience is he's utterly unfair. And if it's not so, well, then let him come and answer my charges in person. Let's have it out face to face, God," he says. "For my conscience is clear. I'm convinced if only we could meet on equal terms, he would have to admit that he had grievously wronged me." And it's as if to anticipate such a legal hearing that in his long closing speech in chapters 29 to 31, Job, as it were, swears an affidavit, outlining in the most moving soliloquy the cruel reversals he had experienced and categorically denying every form of sin which might have merited such unfriendly strokes of divine providence. Finally, at the end of chapter 31, he sums up his case, appealing, as it were, to God against God, almost as if he looked for some independent tribunal that could arbitrate between them. So we read in verse 35 of chapter 31. "Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense," he says. "Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I would put it on like a crown. I would give him an account of my every step. Like a prince, I would approach him." So Job throws down the gauntlet to heaven. What kind of justice is it that punishes a man without a fair trial, he asks. I don't even know the crimes with which I've been charged, and yet I've been condemned. If God is as righteous as he makes out, then let him hear my defense and admit that he has victimized me without warrant. It's he that ought to be in the dock, not I, says Job. And with that extraordinary challenge, laid at some imaginary superior court of appeal, Job rests his case. His three friends have long since fallen silent. They have no reply to such an argument. If Job is speaking the truth about his innocence, then his complaint is unanswerable, at least it is in terms of their theory of retribution. The debate between Job and his friends has reached, it seems, an insoluble impasse. But in that, almost certainly, is exactly where the brilliant, inspired poet who composed this masterpiece wanted to bring us. As we've suggested in previous weeks, this poet has an underlying purpose in writing this epic. He wants to expose the inadequacy of the orthodox theology of his day. Job's three friends probably are intended to represent the wise old men whose traditional learning dominated Israelite culture. When Eliphaz and the others affirm that Job must have deserved his misfortune in some way, they're simply voicing the conventional wisdom of those Jewish sages that the author knew so well. A wisdom, indeed, for which they probably claimed biblical support. Suffering is the divine penalty for sin. Prosperity is the divine reward for righteousness, they said. Moses said it was so of nations in the book of Deuteronomy. Solomon said it was so of individuals in the book of Proverbs. But under the inspiration of God, the author of Job has perceived that that conventional wisdom wasn't sufficient. It might be okay as a generalization, but it had no answer to this grotesque anomaly of Job. It had no answer to the problem of innocent suffering. When Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar fall silent before the relentless assault of Job's logic, our sacred author sees the secular philosophy and the theological orthodoxy of his day, dumbfounded as well. The problem of suffering, he says, is without doubt a major obstacle to monotheistic faith. In his view, there has to be some new insight, some novel approach. If this vexed question of innocent suffering is not to undermine the credibility of biblical religion altogether. And in these concluding chapters, these chapters from 32 onwards, I think the poet is trying to provide us with at least the beginnings of that fresh light that he saw we need. He's got three responses to offer us, and he presents them in succession. The first response is directed to our minds, a new understanding of the purpose of suffering. And that forms the central core of the speeches of Elihu, which you will find from chapters 32 to 37. Four speeches in all of Elihu, which run consecutively. His second response is directed to our hearts. And it points us to a fresh experience of the majesty of God. And that emerges in this extraordinarily dramatic encounter between Jehovah and Job that we read part of just now in chapters 38 to 41. And then his third response is directed to mind and heart together and provides a new assurance of final vindication for the innocent sufferer. That's contained in the final chapter of the book, chapter 42, which we'll be looking at next week. So for our study this morning, we should just be looking at the first two of those responses which the inspired writer tries to give to this problem he set up in the first 31 chapters. Let's look first, then, at the answer he provides for the benefit of our minds, a new understanding of the purpose of suffering. And that I take to be the goal of the Elihu speeches. Just look at chapter 32, where these are introduced to us. the beginning of chapter 32, we read, "So these three men," that is Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, "stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. But Elihu, son of Barachel the Buzite of the family of Ram, became very angry with Job for justifying himself rather than God. He was also angry with the three friends because they had found no way to refute Job and yet had condemned him." Now, those of you who've read commentaries on Job will know that the Elihu speeches are a source of considerable controversy. In fact, the majority of scholars regard them as an interpolation added to the book of Job sometime after its completion. The reason for that are various, but one of the major reasons is that they argue, at any rate the commentators do, that Elihu says nothing new. He doesn't add anything to the debate. They argue that he simply reiterates the arguments of the three friends. As, for instance, in chapter 34, verses 10 and 12. See what Elihu says there. "Listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do evil, from the Almighty to do wrong. He repays a man for what he's done. He brings upon him what his conduct deserves. It is unthinkable that God would do wrong, that the Almighty would pervert justice." Now they say, what's that but just another dogmatic statement of the theory of exact divine retribution, which Job has so successfully discredited when Eliphaz and the others propagated it. No, they say these Elihu speeches must be the work of some later second-rate poet who was shocked by the blasphemous and heretical nature of Job's final remarks and determined that orthodoxy should have the last word. Well, we can't go into the critical questions that surround the Elihu speeches in detail. But suffice it to say, whilst I think it has to be admitted that these speeches aren't always as clear as we would have liked, if you study them carefully, you will quickly discover, I think, that the writer of them certainly believes that he is casting fresh light on the problem and claims so. We look, for instance, at those verses we read at the beginning of chapter 32. He was angry with Job, was Elihu, true, but he was also angry with the three friends because they had found no way to refute Job and yet had condemned him. Far from being then just an echo of these earlier opinions, Elihu is presented to us as somebody who wants to dissociate himself from Eliphaz and his colleagues. And that comes even clearer later on in chapter 32. Look at verse 11. "I waited while you spoke. I listened to your reasoning while you were searching for words. I gave you my full attention. But not one of you has proved Job wrong. None of you has answered his arguments. Do not say, 'We have found wisdom, let God refute him, not man.' Job has not marshaled his words against me, and I will not answer him with your arguments." See that? In other words, Elihu says to the three friends, "Though you won't admit it, Job has beaten you. Your line of argument has just run into the sand. You're reduced to a feeble, we know we're right, even if we can't prove it," sort of attitude. Like we were saying last week, they bury their heads in the sand, the three friends. They shut their eyes and their ears to the unwelcome evidence of Job's innocence because it contradicts their theories. But Elihu will not subscribe to their obscurantist tactics. He's convinced that something can be said in reply to Job. But it involves taking to task not only Job himself, but also the three friends in different respects. See, on the one hand, Elihu insists that the justice of God in his dealings with men must be upheld. He won't give way on that. "If we allow Job to succeed in casting doubt on that," he says, "then biblical faith becomes intellectually indefensible." And in that sense, he does support the arguments of Eliphaz and his cronies, as we saw in chapter 34. "It's unthinkable that God would do wrong," he says, "that the Almighty could pervert justice." We can't let Job win on that point. But on the other hand, Elihu is not prepared to turn a blind eye to the fact of innocent suffering, as Eliphaz and his friends did. He believes there is an explanation of Job's plight, which is consistent with the justice of God, but which, unlike the explanation of Eliphaz, does not require us to maintain that Job is being punished for some secret sin in his earlier life. And it is that new and different explanation that he proceeds to expand, not always clearly, I grant, in the course of his four speeches. Look at chapter 33, because in some ways I think that brings out the line of his argument clearest. Verse 8 of chapter 33, speaking this time to Job. "You have said in my hearing, I heard the very words, I am pure and without sin, I am clean and free from guilt, yet God has found fault with me, he considers me his enemy. He fastens my feet in shackles, he keeps close watch on all my paths. But I tell you, in this you are not right. For God is greater than man. Why do you complain to him that he answers none of man's words? For God does speak." Now what I want you to notice about that section is what Elihu does not say. He does not, as Eliphaz would have done, insist that Job must be lying in his claims to be innocent. No, in Elihu's mind, Job's mistake lies not in the sinfulness of his past life, but in the misinterpretation he is putting on his present suffering. Brainwashed, no doubt, by the doctrine of retribution that was current in his day, Job, you see, has taken it for granted that if God is treating him in this unfortunate way, then it must be because God is hostile to him. "He considers me his enemy," says Job. And it stands to reason God would never make a friend suffer like this. But Elihu doesn't accept that line of logic. "No," he says to Job, "you're wrong to interpret what has happened to you as necessarily a sign of divine anger." What you've got to realize, Job, is two things. First, God is much bigger than you think. His purposes are much grander than you're making allowance for. He's above the kind of petty spite you attribute to him. You attribute it to him only because your idea of God is too much conditioned by your experience of other humans. No, God is greater than man. And secondly, Job, what you've got to realize is that God is much more eager to communicate with you than you think. His concern for your welfare is much more sincere than you give him credit for. You complain of his indifference only because you are not listening appropriately to his voice. For, he says, God does speak. Now one way, now another, though man may not perceive it. Well, questions are obvious. All right, you ask, what is this greater purpose that God has in my suffering? How are his words falling on my deaf ears? In the subsequent verses, Elihu goes on to explain. His greater purpose, says Elihu, is to prevent you, Job, perishing in hell. Or to use Elihu's words, to prevent your soul going down to the pit. And ironically enough, says Elihu, God is trying to communicate with you, Job, to that very end right now, through these sufferings which you are complaining of so bitterly. See how he begins to explain that in verse 14. God does speak now one way, now another, though man may not perceive it, in a dream. In a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men as they slumber in their beds, he may speak in their ears and terrify them with warnings, to turn man from wrongdoing and keep him from pride, to preserve his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. Or a man may be chastened on a bed of pain, with constant distress in his bones. Now, there's no question this is a new perspective in the book of Job, whatever the commentators say. What Elihu is saying here is that God uses negative experiences in people's lives not only as retribution for past crimes, but as a prophylactic against future waywardness. Even in the lives of the righteous, he says, there is danger of falling into sin. In particular, there is the ever-present temptation to complacency and pride. And as the Bible never tires of telling us, pride will take a man to destruction quicker than anything. So God, he says, disciplines us through various kinds of suffering. Even those who are guilty of no major wrongdoing, he disciplines in this way in order to prevent such a spiritual catastrophe in their lives. Sometimes, he says, he does this through psychological suffering, like nightmares, a dream, a vision of the night. You know those terrible dreams you have when you wake up in a cold sweat and you feel full of anxiety? Sometimes he achieves the same end, says Elihu, through physical affliction. Like illness, verse 19, a man may be chastened, notice the word, on a bed of pain. Or sometimes, he says finally, in verses 22 and following, sometimes God warns us through what I suspect these days we would call near-death experiences. Only interestingly, Elihu attributes these to angelic intercession for a man who's on the point of dying. However God chooses to speak, his purpose in such negative experiences, says Elihu, is not necessarily to punish the man, but to chasten him, as he says in verse 19. So the man can be rescued out of the sinful arrogance of which he was in danger, and may be able to testify instead, in humility of heart, verse 27, I sinned and perverted what was right, but I didn't get what I deserved. He redeemed my soul from going down to the pit, and I will live to enjoy the light. And Elihu says this is God's regular policy. He's always dealing with men and women in this way. Verse 29, God does these things to a man twice, even three times during his life. And make no mistake about it, Job. He doesn't treat us like this because he's angry with us and desires to damn us. On the contrary, his purpose is to deliver us from damnation, to turn back his soul from the pit, that the light of life may shine on him, he says. Well, then the implication of Elihu's argument here is clear, you see. Your problem, Job, he's saying, is not your failure to repent of past sins, as Eliphaz makes out. Your problem is your failure to learn from present suffering. In your churlish anger about God's dealings with you, you do stand in danger. You stand in danger of precisely the kind of self-righteous pride which your suffering is meant to chasten out of you. You're justifying yourself, Job. God is speaking to you through your troubles, trying to get you to listen to his correcting voice to bring you away from that attitude. We don't have time to examine all of Elihu's four speeches, but I think if you study them, you will find this thought a constant theme. Look at chapter 36, verse 15, for instance. Those who suffer, God delivers in or through their suffering. He speaks to them in their affliction. You know that? He speaks to them in their affliction. Therefore, he says in verse 21, beware of turning to evil, Job, which you seem to prefer to affliction. God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? See, the three friends earlier in the book centered their ideas of suffering on divine retribution. Who is a judge like God? That was their question. But Elihu introduces here the thought of suffering as divine instruction. Who is a teacher like him? That's the question he asks. It may very well be that that is a thought which somebody here needs to think about. Maybe you, rather like Job, are asking why. Why me, Lord? About something that's happened in your life. We all do, on a number of occasions in our life. Well, the answer of Elihu is really the same as the answer that the book of Hebrews gives us. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there who is not disciplined by his father? No discipline seems pleasant, but painful. But later on, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. In other words, by those who've received it as instruction and have listened to what God was trying to teach them through it. Don't lose heart then, says Hebrews, when the Lord rebukes you, because the Lord only disciplines people he loves and chastens every son he receives. Well, Job didn't realize it, of course, but the fact that he was tested the way he was really a kind of compliment, wasn't it? We've known that ever since chapter 1. It was because he was a righteous man that, according to the prologue, Satan sought to accuse him. Indeed, that's a thought you find again and again in the Bible, that it is God's choicest saints who have to suffer. Even the great apostle Paul had a thorn in the flesh, which God would not take away, no matter how often Paul asked. That thorn, he said, was given me to stop me getting too big for my boots, to stop me becoming arrogant in the great revelations that I'd received. Maybe it's so with us. At least it should be for our encouragement that it could be so. Suffering is not always a divine judgment. Often it is intended rather as a divine instruction. Why, do you know the writer of the Hebrews even tells us that Jesus, who was sinlessly perfect, even Jesus learned obedience through the things he suffered. He could only learn it by receiving suffering as the instruction of his Father. God then has things to teach us through suffering. But Elihu would have us know, we will not learn those things whilst, like Job, we hide behind defensive barricades of righteous indignation or wallow in sullen swamps of self-pity. Sometimes we talk about suffering in silence, don't we? What people don't realize is that there are two kinds of such suffering silence. There is the angry, resentful, sulky silence of a child that has locked itself in its room and refuses obstinately to respond to father's patient knocking on the door. But there is also the submissive, chastened, attentive silence of the child that is hurt by its father's discipline, but wants to understand, wants to listen so that it may hear what it's all about. Elihu's words to Job, then, are perhaps God's word to some of us. God speaks to those who suffer in their affliction, he says, so beware of turning to evil, which you seem to prefer to affliction. Which would you rather be, he asks him, a prosperous sinner or an afflicted saint? For the crucible of suffering is a place of instruction for the Christian, not of destruction. If God is turning the heat on us at the moment, then listen. He's speaking through it. That then is our inspired author's first response to this huge problem of innocent suffering. A response, as I say, directed to the mind. There is, he says, at least in part, an explanation of innocent suffering, provided you realize that it's not just retribution. It can also be instruction.
The sermon continues at the beginning of side 2.
That brings us to the second response which he wants to present. And that's the one we find in those chapters we read a little of. A fresh experience of the majesty of God. Look again at chapter 38, first verses. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." Martin Luther is reported to have chided the scholar Erasmus once. "Erasmus, your thoughts of God are too human." And a similar rebuke really lies at the heart of these final chapters. Elihu has already told Job, God is greater than man. And no doubt Job would have agreed with that, theologically speaking. But it's one thing to believe a truth intellectually, and it is another thing altogether to feel a truth experimentally, isn't it? Part of Job's problem was that, rather like Erasmus, I suspect, he had been over-influenced by rationalists. See, a rationalist is someone who thinks that there's a total explanation available to human understanding for everything that happens. The three friends were rationalists. According to their philosophy, the working of God's justice were fully intelligible to the human mind. It was a law of cause and effect, like gravity. It always worked. You could fully understand what God was doing in any situation by the theory of retribution. And Job had accepted that presupposition, even if he questioned the conclusions that arose out of it. It was because he accepted that rationalistic presupposition that he felt he ought to be able to argue his case with God, like a lawyer in court. "I've got my arguments," he says. "I've got my reasons. Where are God's?" He wanted a rational explanation of his suffering, just as a scientist expects a rational explanation of the fall of an apple. Now, of course, up to a point, that ambition for a reasoned explanation was not misplaced. That's the point of the Elihu speeches. Elihu has made it plain that it is not impossible to give a reasoned account of innocent suffering. Suffering can have positive and saving effects in the lives of people once we realize that it's a loving discipline rather than assuming it necessarily implies divine disfavor. But such a rational interpretation of suffering on its own is not enough. In fact, with some justice, one could call it cold comfort. Couldn't one? "All right, Job, your business has collapsed. Your children have all died. You've got terminal cancer. Never mind, Job. Just ask yourself, what is God teaching me through all this?" Expressed in that crass way, it's appallingly trite, isn't it? Now, what Elihu says about discipline in suffering may be true, but for a person who is actually immersed in the bitterness of suffering, it won't do. Those who are suffering in their hearts are longing for something more than mere reasons. They're yearning for something deeper than mere theological explanations. The man or woman who is truly suffering in their heart is longing for God, for the living God, for a first-hand experience of the felt presence of God, for a personal relationship. "Oh, that I knew where I might find him." That had been Job's cry. And in these climactic concluding chapters, what God offers Job is the answer to that quest. Now, I want you to notice, once again, God doesn't criticize Job for any past sins. Like Elihu, he doesn't try to deny Job's protested innocence. But what I want you to notice, too, is that unlike Elihu, God doesn't address Job's repeated demand for some kind of explanation. He offers no rational justification for Job's suffering. Instead, God just deluges Job with rhetorical questions and ironic challenges. You've got some questions for me, have you, Job? Well, I've got some questions for you. Number one, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Number two, who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know that one, Job. So it goes on. The unanswerable barrage of interrogation rolls on like a torrent. Does Job understand the fundamental forces of the universe? Can he unravel the mystery of creation? Has he visited the remotest corners of the world? Is he master of the weather? Can he direct the celestial constellations? Does he superintend the wild animals of the desert? Can he subdue the mighty hippopotamus or tame the ferocious crocodile? The whole poem is a classic exposition of the wonder of God's world that draws its exotic illustrations from everything, from cosmology to zoology. Now, what's God's point in it all? Is he, as some have said, trying to convince Job that there is a rational order in the universe, a framework of universal logic, of scientific law, as we would say, that's able to provide human beings with an explanation of all phenomena in a way that is fully satisfying to their minds? Well, no, if you read it carefully, I think you will find the purpose of all these rhetorical questions is quite the contrary. Precisely those aspects of creation are selected which testify to the total incomprehensibility of so much of God's world, and its apparent total irrelevance to any purpose God might have for human beings. I mean, why does God bother himself with the wild animals of the desert? What concern does he have with the distant stars? Why on earth did he make so eccentric a bird as the ostrich? So much of creation seems utterly pointless. As pointless as Job's sufferings, no doubt, seem to him. Well, then, does that mean there is no wisdom in it all? No grand design, no ultimate purpose? No, of course it doesn't. The point of the Creator's questions to Job is that as far as we human beings are concerned, it is an inscrutable wisdom that governs this universe. It is a hidden design that orders it. It is a secret purpose that controls its destiny. I suspect that's the reason God spoke out of a storm. A natural phenomena, surely, that is the very antithesis of mathematical order and system. Do you know, these days in talking about weather systems, they even talk about the mathematics of chaos. That's what a storm is. Destructive, confused, unpredictable chaos. Yet it's out of the eye of that whirlwind of irrationality that the Creator speaks to his creature. Do you see what he says in chapter 40, verse 6? The Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I've got more questions for you to answer. Would you discredit my justice? Coming to the nub of the matter here, you see. Would you condemn me in order to justify yourself? Do you then have an arm like God's? And can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, he says. Clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together and shroud their faces in the grave. Then I will admit to you, I myself will admit it, that your own right hand can save you. what God is saying? If you think you have a right, Job, to understand everything that happens to you, then why not go the whole hog? Why not dress up in divine omnipotence and glory and govern the universe yourself? If you can do that, says God, why then I'll gladly admit that I have grossly underestimated you. Such an extraordinary intelligence as yours should, of course, have been furnished with a full explanation of all my actions. How can I have been so impolite as to keep you in the dark? But then if you could rule the world, Job, you wouldn't need either my apology or my blessing, would you? For if you could do that, you would be me. You would be God. You would be your own deliverer. Your own right hand could save you. Back in the 1930s, George Bernard Shaw wrote one of his most pungent apologies for atheism. He entitled it The Adventures of a Black Girl in Search of God. And in that short book, he scorns the God who speaks in these very chapters of Job. He scorns him as a bad debater. God saves himself from defeat at Job's hands, says Shaw, by the old barrister's expedient. When your case is weak, shout louder. When you've got no case at all, abuse the plaintiff's attorney. Job has asked for an explanation of the problem of innocent suffering. How can a just God allow it? And says Shaw, it is no valid reply to jeer at him because he can't catch a crocodile. The answer of God to Job, he says, is not an intelligent answer at all. It's just a supercilious sneer. You can't do this and you can't do that, Job, so why should I explain anything to you? Well, I find it quite easy to sympathize with Shaw's dissatisfaction. He makes his point extremely convincingly in that book. And yet, you know, I suspect that Shaw's hostile reaction to these chapters in Job go a long way to explaining why, in all probability, George Bernard Shaw is in hell today. Shaw's problem, you see, like Job's, was that he had been too much influenced by rationalists. He too wanted the universe to be fully intelligible to man. Any kind of recourse to mystery, for Shaw, was anti-intellectual, unscientific, a cop-out. Not an answer, just a sneer. And so long as we, like Shaw, insist that God must give us a rational justification of the way he runs his universe before we're prepared to believe in him, why then, like Shaw, we shall never find God. For a God that is fully explicable to man is, as Luther said to Erasmus, a too human God. And a too human God is an unnecessary God. What do we need a God like that for? We can replace him with our own science. No, the God of the Bible addresses himself to human reason. It's true. He inspires his prophets, like the author of Job, to interpret his ways to men. And in that sense, we can dare to say we understand God. We have intellectual insight into God's character. We can even talk legitimately about theology, the knowledge of God. But if we think that that means God owes us an explanation of everything he does, or that such an explanation could be accessible to our finite minds, then we're wrong. In fact, we're worse than wrong. we're proud. Insane with a Promethean pride. Arrogant rationalists, like Job, have to be brought to a humbler view of their own intelligence and of their own significance. And if we are not willing for such a humiliation, then God does stand against us. And like a brazen wall, we shall never get through to him. See how Job speaks? I know you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I did speak of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. A different man from the one who said in chapter 31, when he approached God, it would be like a prince. Have you ever stood there? Where Job stands in those verses of chapter 42? Have you ever fallen before the presence of God and taken on your lips words like that? Have you ever felt with Job this extraordinary sense of wonder, worship, which at once hurls us into a humiliating sense of our own insignificance and yet simultaneously, mysteriously, summons us by some inner rapture into personal communion with this God who so unimaginably exceeds our comprehension? Anything of that? See, Job knew all about God, theoretically. That's what he means when he said, I had heard of you by the hearing of my ears. But that kind of theology had not helped him. In the hour of suffering and bereavement, he found theories about God were not enough. And you will find the same. No doubt raised in a Christian home, educated in a Christian school, born in a Christian culture, baptized maybe even in a Christian church. That all the religious background and all the theological training in the world will mean nothing to you when God intervenes in your life and turns the thumbscrews on. Indeed, as in Job's case, religious background and theological training can actually become an obstacle in those circumstances. For the more we have been trained as rationalists, the more difficult it is to hear God speak out of the storm. You ask, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? I spoke of things I did not understand, confesses Job. Things too wonderful for me to know. There are a million things in this world no human mind can understand. The more answers our so-called science discovers, the more questions it poses. And you may be sure that it is among those fundamental mysteries hidden in the abyss of God's infinite intelligence and eternal counsel, that the ultimate answers to this vexed question of innocent suffering lie. Elihu's understanding of suffering may help us a bit, but it won't satisfy us. Nothing on earth will satisfy us on this question of suffering. So when the nightmares invade our sleep, when the pain starts torturing our body, when death hovers on our doorstep, it will not be textbooks of Puritan theology that we shall be crying for. It won't even be copies of Dr. Clements' tapes on Job that we shall ask for. Only a personal, experimental knowledge of God himself will do. A knowledge that goes beyond second-hand, rationalistic theories to a first-hand, heart experience. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Some of you may know the strange and rather evocative poetry of the Victorian Jesuit Gerard Manley Hopkins. He understood what we've been saying this morning. And in one of his greatest poems, The Wreck of the Deutschland, he comes very close to these final chapters of Job. He wrote the poem in the wake of a terrible storm at sea, which had wrecked a ship with the loss of several lives, including a party of Franciscan nuns whom he knew. And in his poem, Hopkins projects himself into the experience of someone on the deck of that stricken ship, facing the horror of this storm and the imminent prospect of doom. Now, through the darkness, Hopkins perceives, just like Job, not the hand of irrational chaos, but of infinite majesty. Thou mastering me, God. That's how he begins. Thou mastering me. That's what it's all about. At the end of the day, Job didn't get any answers. At the end of the day, he discovered instead the futility and indeed the impertinence of thinking he had a right to answers. Like Professor Job. Job had learned that his opinions of God were far less significant than God's opinions of him. But humanistic reason will never accept. It is too Promethean in its arrogance to despise itself and repent in dust and ashes. No, believe me. Believe Job. That is the only place where a suffering soul can find peace. It's the only place where creatures of the dust like us can possibly expect to find God. Not in our mastery of God, but in his mastering of us. Well, let's pray together. Spend a little while in silence. And if you have a good imagination, maybe you can conjure some memory in your mind of some great and formidable experience of the destructive forces of creation that you've felt. maybe even a thunderstorm like Job. And as you think and feel yourself back into that experience, can I invite you with Job to confess once again to God the smallness of the human mind and the insignificance of human existence and the grandeur and majesty of the God who has made us and all this mighty universe that surrounds us.